As far as I remember, we are chapter 9, Equality and the Annihilation of Ego, and second section. No, third. We read the first two until page, at the end of page 225, my edition. Is it correct?
So that begins with this equality cannot come.
This equality cannot come. Yeah,
Okay.
exactly. So the I see Andrea, me, and John. Robert. So let's make us a couple of minutes. Do you have the bell? Oh, I have an idea. Wait a moment. Read it? Yeah, too much. No. So I cannot see it with so from distance. One, two, three.
Would you mute Marco, please? Mute,
You
please.
don't, but yeah, but you don't hear me.
Yes, I
You
hear
don't,
you.
yeah, but so you don't hear me.
Yes, we hear you. Now it's good.
I'm sorry for the pranayama. too loud?
Yes.
And you only get the initial sound and it gets cut off immediately.
Yeah, I know. That's a typical problem.
I think there might be a way to trick it. So instead of just hitting it once like this, you go.
Okay.
Not on the glass. The glass is too sharp.
Too sharp.
Maybe on a bell or a bowl.
Why don't you do that little, John Robert, that little ticking as you did was perfect.
Next time, here we go.
The complexities of Zoom.
Yeah.
And we talk about equality. This equality cannot come except by a protracted ordeal and patient self-discipline. So long as desire is strong, equality cannot come at all, except in periods of quiescence and the fatigue of desire, and it is then more likely to be an inert indifference or desire's recoil from itself than the true calm and a positive spiritual oneness. Moreover, this discipline or this growth into equality of spirit has its necessary epochs and stages. Ordinarily, we have to begin with a period of endurance, for we must learn to confront, to suffer, and to assimilate all contacts. Each fiber in us must be taught not to wince away from that which pains and repels, and not to run eagerly towards that which pleases and attracts, but rather to accept, to face, to bear, and to conquer. All touches we must be strong to bear, not only those that are proper and personal to us, but those born of our sympathy and our conflict with the worlds around, above or below us, and with their peoples. We shall endure tranquilly the action and impact on us of men and things and forces, the pressure of the gods and the assaults of titans. We shall face and engulf in the unstirred seas of our spirit all that can possibly come to us down the ways of the soul's infinite experience. This is the stoical period of the preparation of equality, its most elementary and yet its heroic age. But this steadfast endurance of the flesh and heart and mind must be reinforced by a sustained sense of spiritual submission to a divine will. This living clay must yield not only with a stern or courageous acquiescence, but with knowledge or with resignation, even in suffering, to the touch of the divine hand that is preparing its perfection. A sage, a devout, or even a tender stoicism of the God lover is possible, and these are better than the merely pagan self-reliant endurance which may lend itself to a too great hardening of the vessel of God. For this kind prepares a strength that is capable of wisdom and of love. Its tranquility is a deeply moved calm that passes easily into bliss. The gain of this period of resignation and endurance is the soul's strength equal to all shocks and contacts.
There is next a period of high-seated impartiality and indifference, in which the soul becomes free from exaltation and depression and escapes from the snare of the eagerness of joy as from the dark net of the pangs of grief and suffering. All things and persons and forces, all thoughts and feelings and sensations and actions, one's own no less than those of others, are regarded from above by a spirit that remains intact and immutable and is not disturbed by these things. This is the philosophic period of the preparation of equality, a wide and august movement. but indifference must not settle into an inert turning away from action and experience. It must not be an aversion born of weariness, disgust or distaste, a recoil of disappointed or satiated desire, the sullenness of a baffled and dissatisfied egoism forced back from its passionate aims. These recoils come inevitably in the unripe soul and may in some way help the progress by discouragement of the eager, desire-driven vital nature, but they are not the perfection towards which we labor. The indifference or the impartiality that we must seek after is a calm superiority of the high-seated soul above the contacts of things, Udashina. It regards and accepts or rejects them, but is not moved in the rejection and is not subjected by the acceptance. It begins to feel itself near, kin to, one with a silent self and spirit, self-existent and separate from the workings of nature, which it supports and makes possible, part of or merge in the motionless calm reality that transcends the motion and action of the universe. The gain of this period of high transcendence is the soul's peace unrocked and unshaken by the pleasant ripplings or by the tempestuous waves and billows of the world's movement.
So, Jeffrey, do you know where we are? We're on page 227, the paragraph at the bottom of the page. And I'm the third reader, so you'll be after me, and then Andrea. If we can pass through these two stages of the inner change without being arrested or fixed in either, we are admitted to a greater divine equality, which is capable of a spiritual ardor and tranquil passion of delight, a rapturous, all-understanding and all-possessing equality of the perfected soul, an intense and even wideness and fullness of its being, embracing all things. This is the supreme period, and the passage to it is through the joy of a total self-giving to the divine and to the universal mother. For strength is then crowned by a happy mastery. Peace deepens into bliss. The possession of the divine calm is uplifted and made the ground for the possession of the divine movement. But if this greater perfection is to arrive, the soul's impartial high-seatedness looking down from above on the flux of forms and personalities and movements and forces must be modified and changed into a new sense of strong and calm submission and a powerful and intense surrender. This submission will be no longer a resigned acquiescence, but a glad acceptance. For there will be no sense of suffering or of the bearing of a burden or cross. Love and delight and the joy of self-giving will be its brilliant texture. And this surrender will be not only to a divine will which we perceive and accept and obey, but to a divine wisdom in the will, which we recognize, and a divine love in it, which we feel and rapturously suffer, the wisdom and love of a supreme spirit and self of ourselves and all with which we can achieve a happy and perfect unity. A lonely power, peace, and stillness is the last word of the philosophic equality of the sage. But the soul, in its integral experience, liberates itself from this self-created status and enters into the sea of a supreme and all-embracing ecstasy of the beginningless and endless beatitude of the eternal. Then we are at last capable of receiving all contacts with a blissful equality, because we feel in them the touch of the imperishable love and delight, the happiness absolute that hides ever in the heart of things. The gain of this culmination in a universal and equal rapture is the soul's delight and the opening gates of the bliss that is infinite, the joy that surpasses all understanding. So there we have a break. Do we want to talk about that section that we just read? And welcome to Jeffrey Jin. What occurred to me when I was reading that last paragraph was Sri Aurobindo's, when he had his fall, I think it was in 1939, when he fell and broke his thigh bone. And I seem to remember a comment.
I don't hear you. Do you hear me?
You can't hear me? So can you hear me okay too, Andrea?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So I seem to remember in some of the conversations, because after that he had people come into his room and there were conversations that kind of broke this long period of isolation that he had. And I seem to remember him talking about the difficulty he found in converting the agony of that break into Ananda, as he's talking about here in this passage. So I took that as a kind of a comfort. This is a very high state that he's talking about here at the end. All right, can you hear now, Marco? I guess not, huh? So we're waiting for Marco to see if he can figure out his sound problem here.
Well, maybe we need to speak for him to know whether or not he's hearing.
Yeah, I've spoken a couple of times and I don't see any sign that he hears us.
Yeah. In here now, Marco?
Is it any better, Marco? How can you hear us yet?
Yeah, my headset does not work properly. I don't know what it is, but yes, now I can hear it. Sometimes it goes away, then I have to restart all the sequence.
Okay.
I don't know what you said, but it's fine. Go ahead, nevertheless.
Okay. CJ, it's your turn.
Oh, it's my turn. Okay. Before this labor for the annihilation of desire and the conquest of the soul's equality can come to its absolute perfection and fruition, that turn of the spiritual movement must have been completed, which leads to the abolition of the sense of ego. But for the worker, the renunciation of the egoism of action is the most important element in this change. For even when, by giving up the fruits and the desire of the fruits to the master of the sacrifice, we have parted with the egoism of rajasic desire, we may still have kept the egoism of the worker. Still, we are subject to the sense that we are ourselves the doer of the act, ourselves its source, and ourselves the giver of the sanction. It is still the I that chooses and determines. It is still the I that undertakes the responsibility and feels the demerit or the merit.
I think you, it's your turn. I think it's your turn, huh? You begin.
So are you having a new paragraph here? Because I don't.
Yes, it's a new paragraph for me. Yeah.
After the merit. Okay, so I have an old edition. An entire removal of this separative ego sense is an essential aim of our yoga. If any ego is to remain in us for a while, it is only a form of it, which knows itself to be a form and is ready to disappear as soon as a true center of consciousness is manifested or built in us. That true center is a luminous formulation of the one consciousness and a pure channel and instrument of the one existence, a support for the individual manifestation and action of the universal force. It gradually reveals behind it the true person in us, the central eternal being, an everlasting being of the supreme, a power and portion of the transcendent Shakti.
Here too, in this movement by which the soul divests itself gradually of the obscure robe of the ego, there is a progress by marked stages. For not only the fruit of works belongs to the Lord alone, but our works also must be His. He is the true Lord of our actions, no less than of our results. This we must not see with the thinking mind only. It must become entirely true to our entire consciousness and will. The sadhaka has not only to think and know, but to see and feel concretely and intensely, even in the moment of the working and in its initiation and whole process, that his works are not his at all, but are coming through his from the supreme existence. He must be always aware of a force, a presence, a will that acts through his individual nature. But there is in taking this term the danger that he may confuse his own disguised or sublimated ego or an inferior power with the Lord and substitute its demands for the supreme dictates. He may fall into a common ambush of this lower nature and distort his supposed surrender to a higher power into an excuse for a magnified and uncontrolled indulgence of his own self-will and even of his desires and passions. The great sincerity is asked for, and has to be imposed not only on the conscious mind, but still more on the subliminal part of us, which is full of hidden movements. For there is there, especially in our subliminal vital nature, an incorrigible charlatan and actor. The sadhaka must first have advanced far in the elimination of desire and in the firm equality of his soul towards all workings and all happenings before he can utterly lay down the burden of his works on the divine. At every moment, he must proceed with a vigilant eye upon the deceits of the ego and the ambushes of the misleading powers of darkness, whoever represent themselves as the one source of light and truth, and take on them a simulacrum of divine forms in order to capture the soul of the seeker.
Immediately, he must take the further step of relegating himself to the position of the witness. Aloof from the Prakriti, impersonal and dispassionate, he must watch the executive nature force at work within him and understand its actions. He must learn by this separation to recognize the play of her universal forces, distinguish her interweaving of light and night, the divine and the undivine, and detect her formidable powers and beings that use the ignorant human creature. Nature works in us, says the Gita, through the triple quality of Prakriti, the quality of light and good, the quality of passion and desire, and the quality of obscurity and inertia. The seeker must learn to distinguish, as an impartial and discerning witness of all that proceeds within this kingdom of his nature, the separate and the combined action of these qualities. He must pursue the workings of the cosmic forces in him through all the labyrinth of their subtle, unseen processes and disguises, and know every intricacy of the maze. As he proceeds in this knowledge, he will be able to become the giver of the sanction and no longer remain an ignorant tool of nature. At first, he must induce the nature force in its action on his instruments to subdue the working of its two lower qualities and bring them into submission to the quality of light and good. And afterwards, he must persuade that again to offer itself, so that all three may be transformed by a higher power into their divine equivalents, supreme repose and calm, divine illumination and bliss, the eternal divine dynamis, tapas. The first part of this discipline and change can be firmly done in principle by the will of the mental being in us, but its full execution and the subsequent transformation can be done only when the deeper psychic soul increases its hold on the nature and replaces the mental being as its ruler. When this happens, he will be ready to make, not only with an aspiration and intention, and an initial and progressive self-abandonment, but with the most intense actuality of dynamic self-giving, the complete renunciation of his works to the Supreme Will. By degrees, his mind of an imperfect human intelligence will be replaced by a spiritual and illumined mind, and that can, in the end, enter into the supramental truth light. He will then no longer act from his nature of the ignorance with its three modes of confused and imperfect activity, but from a diviner nature of spiritual calm, light, power, and bliss. He will act not from an amalgam of an ignorant mind and will, with the drive of a still more ignorant heart of emotion and the desire of the life being and the urge and instinct of the flesh, but first from a spiritualized self and nature, and last from a supramental truth consciousness and its divine force of supernature.
Thus are made possible the final steps when the veil of nature is withdrawn and the seeker is face to face with the master of all existence, and his activities are merged in the action of a supreme energy which is pure, true, perfect, and blissful forever. Thus can he utterly renounce to the supramental Shakti his works as well as the fruits of his works, and act only as the conscious instrument of the eternal worker. No longer giving the sanction, he will rather receive in his instruments and follow in her hands a divine mandate. No longer doing works, he will accept their execution through him by her unsleeping force. No longer willing the fulfillment of his own mental constructions and the satisfaction of his own emotional desires, he will obey and participate in an omnipotent will that is also an omniscient knowledge and a mysterious, magical, and unfathomable love, and a vast bottomless sea of the eternal bliss of existence.
Comments? I think we will finish this chapter before going on to the next. Okay, just another sarcastic, negative note. But it's yet another chapter of the sort, easier said than done. Because, yeah. I understand it mentally. It's easy to understand mentally. This is it's a classical example of what is easy to understand mentally, but it's not about the mind here. You know? Something really. This is tough in a certain sense because it is the first. This is the beginning of the yoga, and I'm still in the beginning. After so many years, especially where he says, the thing with the desire. I don't remember where it is. He says, you must give up all desires, otherwise, that's not easy. But, well, at least the good news is that we know what has to be done. Yeah. This is a kind of chapter that needs step by step daily experience and practice.
Yeah, I think for most of us it needs time. I mean, time to kind of sink into what he's really talking about in our own experience. When we were reading this last part, I was thinking about the emphasis here is on equality, and Divishish Banerjee has a really interesting article that he wrote a couple of years ago on the evolution of Sri Aurobindo's yoga during Sri Aurobindo's life. And he talked about three stages that he could identify. Divishish talked about three stages that he could identify. And in the first stage, which is what this writing comes from, this early stage when he was writing these six or seven books at the same time for the Arya, the principal emphasis of his yoga, according to what Devishis said, was equality. And then when the mother came, that gradually changed. And so Devishish was tracing this in his writing. And that gradually changed to an emphasis on the psychic being. So the psychic being came to the front. The mother brought that notion to him, I think, from Theon. And Sri Aurobindo recognized that as part of his yoga. And so there's a little bit of it in here, maybe from his revisions, I don't know. There was more and more an emphasis that the psychic being is really the mover of the yoga and what we have to identify with. And then the last period, Debashis says that Sri Aurobindo, towards the end of his life, focused on the surrender as the principal action, surrender to the Divine Mother. And I thought that's really interesting. And he also talked about in that article, I don't know if any of you all have seen it, it's, I think, 2 or 3 years old, and it's online. But he talked about the different audiences that Sri Aurobindo was speaking to in these three different phases of his life. And the first audience was people that were deeply involved in Indian yoga and knew the Indian yoga. And then gradually he moved into more and more transpersonal language, so that he was actually talking to people who perhaps didn't know Indian yoga very well, or perhaps hadn't met in person the mother, but still could be doing this yoga, or still could recognize this surrender to the Divine Mother, or to whatever they would call the Divine Mother, as an essential part of yoga.
I really like his description of the misleading powers of darkness, whoever represent themselves as the one source of light and truth, and take on them a simulacrum of divine forms in order to capture the soul of the seeker. It seems that those people who are on the difficult journey, in my mind, of being a spiritual teacher, they can, I mean, not that I can't fall on that myself, I do, but we see a lot of darkness in their actions, but they are so enamored with their own spirituality that they can't see it, I believe. And many people who follow them can't see it. And it creates a lot of suffering. I think Mother said somewhere that the spiritual ego is because it's so glorious, it's the hardest to recognize. Because it looks so beautiful, it shines.
I had a spiritual teacher who said, the more enlightened you get, the more enlightened your ego gets.
Gets smarter all the time.
My only comment on reading this section is the same comment I have every time I read all of this stuff is, I feel like I've already read it in the Vedas. I know he does more nuanced, you know, and it's within his systemic understanding of things, which is different from the Vedas. But I do feel like what we discussed yesterday seemed to me, Andrea, seemed to be much of what we just read now today. So, yeah.
So shall we do this chapter again? Usually we read something twice and begin at the beginning of that chapter or go to the next one. I wouldn't mind to go to the next one myself, but that's...
I also think next one is okay for me, but if you think you need to reread it, it's okay also.
Everyone okay with continuing to chapter 10?
Sure.
Okay. The chapter 10, the three modes of nature. To transcend the natural action of the lower prakriti is indispensable to the soul if it is to be free in itself and free in its works. Harmonious subjection to this actual universal nature, a condition of good and perfect work for the natural instruments, is not an ideal for the soul, which should rather be subject to God and his Shakti, but master of its own nature. As agent or as channel of the Supreme Will, it must determine by its vision and sanction or refusal the use that shall be made of the storage of energy. Harmonious subjection to this actual universal nature and condition of good and perfect work for the natural instruments is not an ideal for the soul, which should rather be subject to God and his Shakti, but master of its own nature. As agent or as channel of the Supreme Will, it must determine by its vision, sanction, or refusal the use that shall be made of the storage of energy, the conditions of environment, the rhythm of combined movement, which are provided by Prakriti for the labor of the natural instruments, mind, life, and body. But this inferior nature can only be mastered if she is surmounted and used from above. And this can only be done by a transcendence of her forces, qualities, and modes of action. Otherwise, we are subject to her conditions and helplessly dominated by her, not free in the spirit.
The idea of the three essential modes of nature is a creation of the ancient Indian thinkers, and its truth is not at once obvious, because it was a result of long psychological experiment and profound internal experience. Therefore, without a long inner experience, without intimate self-observation and intuitive perception of the nature forces, it is difficult to grasp accurately or firmly utilize. Read this sentence again. Therefore, without a long inner experience, without intimate self-observation and intuitive perception of the nature forces, it is difficult to grasp accurately or firmly utilize. Still, certain broad indications may help the seeker on the way of works to understand, analyze, and control by his assent or refusal the combinations of his own nature. These modes are termed in the Indian books qualities, gunas, and are given the names sattva, rajas, tamas. Sattva is the force of equilibrium and translates in quality as good and harmony and happiness and light. Rajas is a force of kinesis and translates in quality as struggle and effort, passion and action. Tamas is a force of inconscience and inertia and translates in quality as obscurity and incapacity and inaction. Ordinarily used for psychological self-analysis, these distinctions are valid also in physical nature. Each thing and every existence in the lower prakriti contains them, and its process and dynamic form are the result of the interaction of these qualitative powers.
Every form of things, whether animate or inanimate, is a constantly maintained poise of natural forces in motion and is subject to an unending stream of helpful, disturbing, or disintegrating contacts from other combinations of forces that surround it. Our own nature of mind, life, and body is nothing else than such a formative combination and poise. In the reception of the environing contacts and the reaction to them, the three modes determine the temper of the recipient and the character of the response. Inert and inept, he may suffer them without any responsive reaction, any motion of self-defense, or any capacity of assimilation and adjustment. This is the mode of tamas, the way of inertia. The stigmata of tamas are blindness and unconsciousness and incapacity and unintelligence, sloth and indolence and inactivity and mechanical routine and the mind's torpor and the life's sleep and the soul's slumber. Its effect, if uncorrected by other elements, can be nothing but disintegration of the form or the poise of the nature without any new creation or new equilibrium or force of kinetic progress. At the heart of this inert impotence is the principle of ignorance and an inability or slothful unwillingness to comprehend, seize, and manage the stimulating or assailing contact, the suggestion of environing forces, and their urge towards fresh experience.
On the other hand, the recipient of nature's contacts, touched and stimulated, solicited or assailed by her forces, may react to the pressure or against it. She allows, encourages, impels him to strive, to resist, to attempt, to dominate, or engross his environment, to assert his will, to fight and create and conquer. This is the mode of rajas, the way of passion and action, and the thirst of desire, struggle and change and new creation, victory and defeat, and joy and suffering, and hope and disappointment are its children, and build the many-colored house of life in which it takes its pleasure. But its knowledge is an imperfect or a false knowledge, and brings with it ignorant effort, error, and a constant misadjustment, pain of attachment, disappointed desire, grief of loss, and failure. The gift of rajas is kinetic force, energy, activity, the power that creates and acts and can overcome, but it moves in the wrong lights or the half-lights of the ignorance, and it is perverted by the touch of the asura, rakshasa, and pishaka. The arrogant ignorance of the human mind and its self-satisfied perversions and presumptuous errors, the pride and vanity and ambition, the cruelty and tyranny and beast wrath and violence, the selfishness and baseness and hypocrisy and treachery and vile meanness, the lust and greed and rapacity, the jealousy, envy, and bottomless ingratitude that disfigure the earth nature are the natural children of this indispensable but strong and dangerous turn of nature.
But the embodied being is not limited to these two modes of prakriti. There is a better and more enlightened way in which he can deal with surrounding impacts and a stream of the world forces. There is possible a reception and reaction with clear comprehension, poise, and balance. This way of natural being has the power that, because it understands, sympathizes. It fathoms and controls and develops nature's urge and her ways. It has an intelligence that penetrates her processes and her significances and can assimilate and utilize. There's a lucid response that is not overpowered, but adjusts, corrects, harmonizes, elicits the best in all things. This is the mode of sattva, the turn of nature that is full of light and poise, directed to good, to knowledge, to delight and beauty, to happiness, right understanding, right equilibrium, right order. Its temperament is the opulence of a bright clearness of knowledge and a loosened warmth of sympathy and closeness. A fineness and enlightenment, a governed energy, an accomplished harmony and poise of the whole being is the consummate achievement of the sattvic nature.
No existence is cast entirely in the single mold of any of these three modes of the cosmic force. All three are present in everyone and everywhere. There is a constant combining and separation of their shifting relations and interpenetrating influences, often a conflict, a wrestling of forces, a struggle to dominate each other. All have in great or in small extent or degree, even if sometimes in a hardly appreciable minimum, their sattvic states and clear tracts of or inchoate tendencies of light, clarity, and happiness, fine adaptation and sympathy with the environment, intelligence, poise, right mind, right will and feeling, right impulse, virtue, order. All have their rajasic moods and impulses and turbid parts of the desire, of desire and passion and struggle, perversion and falsehood and error, unbalanced joy and sorrow, aggressive push to work and eager creation and strong or bold or fiery or fierce reactions to the pressure of the environment and to life's assaults and offers. All have their tamasic states and constant obscure parts, their moments or points of unconsciousness, their long habit or their temporary velleities of weak resignation or dull acceptance, their constitutional feebleness or movements of fatigue, negligence, and indolence, and their lapses into ignorance and incapacity, depression and fear, and cowardly recoil or submission to the environment and to the pressure of man and events and forces. Each one of us is subject in some directions of his energy of nature or in some parts of his mind or character, in other rajasic, tamasic, in others. According as one or other of the modes usually dominates his general temperament and type of mind and turn of action, it is said of him that he is the sattvic, the rajasic, or the tamasic man. But few are always of one kind, and none is entire in his kind. The wise are not always or wholly wise. The intelligent are intelligent only in patches. The saint suppresses in himself many unsaintly movements, and the evil are not entirely evil. The dullest has his unexpressed or unused and undeveloped capacities, the most timorous his moments or his way of courage, the helpless and the weakling a latent part of strength in his nature. The dominant gunas are not the essential soul type of the embodied being, but only the index of the formation he has made for his life or during his present existence and at a given moment of his evolution in time. So I lost a bit while reading. I lost because he says all have in great or in small extent, all have their rajasic moods, all have their tamasic state. He means the persons, people. What? Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
The subject of that whole paragraph is existence. He says no existence is cast entirely in the single mode. So I think he's talking about more than just humans. No existence, he says, is cast entirely in any one of these three modes, but they're mixed.
Yeah, in fact, that confused me a bit. So no existence is cast entirely in the single mode. So what does he mean when he points at all to the existence or to what? There's a constant combining separation there, he said. There's a constant combining and separation of their shifting. So there, who all three are present in everyone. So he means the gunas. Or Anna, all, he means the gunas, the qualities. All having a great or small extent, a degree in. But that's, I don't get this. I'm not sure.
When he says all three are present, is that what you mean, Marco? He's talking about all three of these qualities are present.
Ah, he says in everyone and everywhere.
Mm-hmm. So it's the three qualities and is what all refers to.
So that's three qualities. Okay. So yes. But all the three qualities have their rajasic moods and impulse and turbid parts. So all qualities have also, so sattva has also a rajasic and tamasic aspect. That's what it means. Yeah.
Right, it reminds me of like the Chinese, the yin and yang, that there's always one inside of the other.
Yeah.
Nothing is pure, you know. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The tamasic is interesting because it seems to be mostly negative, but at one point he says that, I'm not sure if I can find it now, but he says that there's a kind of, hang on, I've got it marked here. The suggestion of environing forces and their urge towards fresh experience. So there's the sense that out of the negativity comes a yearning for something else. So that it also has that push towards freshness that is different. You know, so they all have a positive and a negative side to them. Yeah.
One of the positive aspects of tamas is stability.
Hmm. And maybe patience.
Maybe patience, yeah.
Yeah.
So the tamas is grounding in its, you know, in its positive side. So rocks and earth, you know, dirt, and they're kind of tamasic in principle, and they're very grounding. It's a good thing we have them, otherwise we'd be sinking in, you know, all the time when we tried to walk around. And they also, they're very slow motion, have their own ways of acting in other ways than just a sloth or immobility.
Yeah, in fact, he frequently says that the primary quality and aspect of matter generally is tamas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's neither negative nor positive. It is matter. Without matter, nothing. But I think it's also very interesting, and that's what I was thinking about. Coincidentally, just these days, I was thinking about this sattva, rajas, tamas in the physical universe, in nature, he says. It's not just about psychology. He means it that it is something that is also inherent in the physicality of things, in the physics, in matter, in the processes of nature. In fact, I was thinking, for example, a phenomenon like homeostasis. How do you say homeostasis? Homeostasis. It is a biological process, but it reminds me very much to these three principles, because homeostasis is a biological process where a cell or an organism tries to find a balance, a sattvic state. It would make the parallel with a sattvic state. And it does so by a reaction to the environment. This reaction is a rajasic activity. And the tamasic part is, well, you said it just now, John Robert, stability. When it finds its stability, it is. And so I think we can find a lot of, I don't know if it's just analogies or if it has deeper truths. He means that it has a deeper truth. But sometimes it's difficult to make analogies. Also, in modern biology, you have this idea of to describe all the biological processes by information theory. What's information theory is about an input, a memory, and an output. You can also see the three gunas. It's like a play of three gunas. And I'm just wondering, and I think it has a deeper, much deeper, profound meaning also in the physical world, not just in the psych. Because usually when people speak about the gunas, they think of the psychological character of people, which is also right, of course. And it's something much deeper entrenched in the universe as a whole, I think, the manifestation.
Okay. Well, from Einstein, we know that all matter has at least tamas and rajas.
Yeah, that's a good example. I like this example. Yeah. So should we proceed, or how do you feel, or other comments? Because this is now the first section of chapter 10. You see?
And I think we could go on.
Yeah.
We could keep going, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Whose turn is it? Is it my turn?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
When the sadhaka has once stood back from the action of prakriti within him or upon him, and not interfering, not amending or inhibiting, not choosing or deciding, allowed its play and analyzed and watched the process, he soon discovers that her modes are self-dependent and work as a machine, once put in action, works by its own structure and propelling forces. The force and the propulsion come from prakriti and not from the creature. Then he realizes how mistaken was his impression that his mind was the doer of his works. His mind was only a small part of him and a creation and engine of nature. Nature was acting all the while in her own modes, moving the three general qualities about as a girl might play with her puppets. His ego was all along a tool and plaything. His character and intelligence, his moral qualities and mental powers, his creations and works and exploits, his anger and forbearance, his cruelty and mercy, his love and his hatred, his sin and his virtue, his light and his darkness, his passion of joy and his anguish of sorrow, were the play of nature, to which the soul attracted, won, and subjected, lent its passive concurrence. And yet the determinism of nature or force is not all. The soul has a word to say in the matter. But the secret soul, the Purusha, not the mind or ego, since these are not independent entities, they are parts of nature. For the soul's sanction is needed for the play, and by an inner silent will, as the Lord and giver of the sanction, it can determine the principle of the play and intervene in its combinations, although the execution in thought and will and act and impulse must still be nature's part and privilege. The Purusha can dictate a harmony for nature to execute, not by interfering in her functions, but by a conscious regard on her, which she transmutes at once, or after much difficulty, into translating idea and dynamic impetus and significant figure.
An escape from the action of the two inferior gunas is very evidently indispensable if we are to transmute our present nature into a power and form of the divine consciousness and an instrument of its forces. Tamas obscures and prevents the light of the divine knowledge from penetrating into the dark and dull corners of our nature. Tamas incapacitates and takes away the power to respond to divine impulse and the energy to change and the will to progress and make ourselves plastic to a greater Shakti. Rajas perverts knowledge, making our reason the accomplice of falsehood and the abettor of every wrong movement, disturbs and twists our life force and its impulses, oversets the balance and health of the body. Rajas captures all high-born ideas and high-seated movements and turns them to a false and egoistic use. Even divine truth and divine influences, when they descend into the earthly plane, cannot escape this misuse and seizure. Tamas unenlightened and Rajas unconverted, no divine change or divine life is possible.
An exclusive resort to sattva would seem to be the way of escape. But there is this difficulty that no one of the qualities can prevail by itself against its two companions and rivals. If, envisaging the quality of desire and passion as the cause of disturbance, suffering, sin, and sorrow, we strain and labor to quell and subdue it, Rajas sinks, but tamas rises. For the principle of activity dulled, inertia takes its place. A quiet peace, happiness, knowledge, love, right sentiment can be provided by the principle of light. But if rajas is absent or completely suppressed, the quiet in the soul tends to become a tranquility of inaction, not the firm ground of a dynamic change. Ineffectively, right thinking, right doing, good, mild, and even, the nature may become in its dynamic parts sattva tamasic, neutral, pale-tinted, uncreative, or emptied of power. Mental and moral obscurity may be absent, but so are the intense springs of action, and this is a hampering limitation and another kind of incompetence. For tamas is a double principle. It contradicts rajas by inertia. It contradicts sattva by narrowness, obscurity, and ignorance. And if either is depressed, it pours in to occupy its place.
If we call in rajas again to correct this error and bid it ally itself to sattva and be and by their united agency endeavor to get rid of the dark principle, we find that we have elevated our action, but there is again subjection to rajasic eagerness, passion, disappointment, suffering, anger. These movements may be more exalted in their scope and spirit and action than before, but they are not the peace, the freedom, the power, and the self-mastery at which we long to arrive. Wherever desire and ego harbor, passion and disturbance harbor with them, wherever desire and ego harbor, passion and disturbance harbor with them and share their life. If we seek a compromise between the three modes, sattva leading, the others subordinate, still we have only arrived at a more temperate action of the play of nature. A new poise has been reached, but the spiritual freedom and mastery are not in sight, or else are still only a far-off prospect.
A radically different movement has to draw us back from the gunas and lift us above them. The error that accepts the action of the modes of nature must cease. For as long as it is accepted, the soul is involved in their operations and subjected to their law. Sattva must be transcended as well as rajas and tamas. The golden chain must be broken no less than the leaden fetters and the bond ornaments of a mixed alloy. The Gita prescribes to this end a new method of self-discipline. It is to stand back in oneself from the action of the modes and observe this unsteady flux as the witness seated above the surge of the forces of nature. He is the one who watches, but is impartial and indifferent, aloof from them on their own level, and in his native posture, high above them. As they rise and fall in their waves, the witness looks, observes, but neither accepts nor for the moment interferes with their course. First, there must be the freedom of the impersonal witness. Afterwards, there can be the control of the master, the Ishwara.
So he says that we must transcend also the sattva. But I can see how,
it's still the state of the small self. It's still the state of the ego.
Okay, but practically, I mean, as a practice, I can see how it can stand back from rajas. I can see how it can stand back from tamas. But how do you stand back from sattva? For me, standing back is a sattvic state in itself.
So my sense there, I like your question, is that one also witnesses that you don't identify, this is me, look how good I am. You see, that's the trick.
Well, this is, of course, yes, this would be the ego. Yeah.
So Sri Aurobindo is talking about two different principles. He's talking about the nature principle, and he says the three gunas are part of nature. Part of all nature, all manifestation. But the other principle he's talking about is the soul, which is at first behind the scenes, and nature is in front, and all the stuff that we're doing and we identify as ourselves is actually nature using the gunas and working through us. But with the witness, he's talking about the soul, which is a different principle than this is the Purusha now. It's the Prakriti.
Yeah, so it means that one, if one has transcended the sattva, one has already realized one's, yeah, he says it at the end, the impersonal witness. What was this? So yeah, the impersonal witness. So you have a real realization. It's not just an exercise. It is already something where you have transcended it. You have been identified with the Purusha. You have this Purusha witness. Yeah, but this is already a higher stage, I think, of realization, as I understand it.
Yeah, that seems to be the way that Sri Aurobindo uses these terms. The term of Purusha and Prakriti, you know, he got those terms, according to Debashish, from one of the Indian traditions, and he's using them in his own sense. And he says specifically that the Prakriti is nature, and the gunas are the three modes of nature. But the Purusha is not the same as Prakriti, and so it has this witness capability. And the witness is this first stage before it begins to be the sanction, not just the witness.
Like when you said earlier, Marco, about homeostasis. So, you know, those homeostasis is almost the defining natural system in a sense, right? It's a very omnipresent kind of biological system, and it has the three components to it. But the equilibrium or balance that you find in the homeostasis is different from the, non-attachment, in my mind, they're a different function. The one is to do with finding a systemic solution to the problems of energy and inertia, if you like. And other is maybe like what John Roberts said, more about the soul or more about... anyway, I'm not maybe fully coherent. I'm rather tired and...
I'm also not sure if we are just making metaphorical analogies, because these kind of things came to my mind recently. So I don't take this as a coincidence that I'm reading these things. So I take it a bit more seriously. But I was thinking all this for last week, continuously came to my mind this idea of the three gunas. And I see the analogy, one sees this intuitively, with physical systems, biological system, physical phenomena. And I'm wondering if it's just a metaphor or if effectively indicates a deeper reality that connects really to these things. I have no strong opinion on this, but I was seeing the analogy between stability of inner homeostatic system and tamas. It's not negative. It's an example of something that is not negative at all, because if we would not have this tamas in the sense of stability of self-regulation, for example, the temperature and so on, we would die quite quickly, I think. So that could be a good example of how tamas is a more general term that must not necessarily be taken as something negative. Another analogy that I find quite compelling is how the information flow from the DNA to protein synthesis, and also from the input of the environment to, nowadays we know that there are so-called epigenetic influences, mechanisms from the environment on the genetic code, from the genetic code to the protein synthesis and back. It's also in a certain sense an information flow that you can see as input, memory, output, that is reception, retention, and reaction, which are only just three other words that characterize the gunas again. Maybe only analogies, just my metaphorical mind that likes to jump to these conclusions. Maybe not. I don't know.
I don't know either, but I'm thinking we're talking about really different systems, talking about scientifically thinking about things and you know, Indian spiritual philosophy categories like this. And so I think one would have to look at assumptions and maybe even languaging if we were going to pursue that question that you're raising.
But that's why I was struck also when he said ordinarily used for psychological self-analysis, these distinctions are valid also in physical nature. So he says, it's not only about psychology here. It's something also inherent in matter and material phenomena of the physical universe. And that's what I like. My scientific mind jumps on it.
So I'm getting ready to call it a day. How is that for everybody else?
It's almost 1:30. That seems like a good time to be ending.
We had some.
I'm not sure I'd make it. More, I'm starting to fade. I didn't get enough sleep last night. So,
can you use your little thing that you have? That's because we don't have good systems, Jeffrey Jen.
You
for
want
the meditation?
Oh, you want another meditation to finish? Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Andrea and Marco and Jeffrey Jen for
being
here today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.